Thank you for welcoming me to your church, and thank you for all the people who led worship and all the technology. I know as someone who has to do that as part of my job too, it can be very challenging. So thank you for showing up today as well. If you're here, you took a risk, came out to Sunday. I heard this is your second week in person, so woo, you made it. So thank you. And today we're talking about the poetry of Scripture. And sometimes in life, you are motivated by what is true. Maybe it's a math test or election results or a medical exam that you're waiting for the results from. But sometimes you are motivated by what is practical. Exercise routines, do they work? Are they effective? Are they going to slim me down for the summer? Or cooking recipes or IKEA manuals? But often in life, you are motivated more deeply by what is beautiful. Maybe it's a movie you love, or music you love to listen to, or someone you love, or maybe it's just nature. You love to be out in nature. I'm increasingly convinced that evangelism in our world today is the work of the artists. As I speak with many college students today, their primary questions are not necessarily, is the Bible true, or is God real, or does Christianity work, but is it beautiful? Is it compelling? Does it wake me up in the morning and inspire me? And so today we're talking about the poetry of Scripture, because at least a third of the Bible is poetry. And that, when I heard that, I was shocked, because growing up, I didn't come to the Bible for poetry, right? And yes, the Bible is true. The Bible is practical, but the Bible is also overwhelmingly beautiful. And that's why there's so much poetry in the Bible. And so today we're talking about the poetry of Scripture. What is poetry? I'm not a poet. I didn't grow up reading a lot of poetry, and some of you may have a lot more experience in it than me, but basically poetry is the artistic use of words to evoke powerfully meaning and experience. You can say a lot in just a few words. It's amazing. And actually, almost every culture around the world has some form of poetry. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that interesting? Like, whether you're from China or from Europe or from America or India or Russia, you have this tradition of using language and words to evoke meaning and experience. And there's the same for the Hebrew authors of the Bible. And why is poetry important? Because our human experience, even our day-to-day experience, is too complicated to just convey through information, right? I could tell you about my wife and tell you how tall she is. I won't tell you how much she weighs, but I can tell you where she's born or what year she was, you know, or where, what her family, how many people are in her family. And that can only tell you so much about who she is. But I could tell you a poem that I wrote about her, or why I love her. And that tells you something much deeper about who she is, right? And so poetry expresses our experience and longings much more effectively than we could with just facts. And if it's one, human experience is already complicated, but now how do you talk about the divine? How do you talk about God? And so this is why I believe the authors of the Bible were inspired to write poetry about God and about their experience of Him. And so, you know, creeds and doctrine and theology sharpens our minds to know about God and to speak about Him clearly. That's very important. But poetry, prayer, and worship draws our hearts and our bodies and our whole communities to love God. So, in just a second, Alfred, I'm going to ask you to show the video. Just want to give you a heads up. Before we do that, if you're like me, I didn't come, as I said before, I didn't come to the Bible to read poetry. I often would skip over it. Right? I said, give me the good stuff. Tell me what happens. Give me the story. Give me, what am I supposed to believe about God? Right? Like, just tell me what I need to know. And so maybe that's you, maybe that's not. And so today I hope that can give you maybe a new appreciation of how that is in the Bible. When I grew up, I turned to the Bible and I would often look for something quick and clear, right? Like, I almost wanted God to just Instead of the Bible that he gave us, I just wanted him to give us a systematic theology textbook divided into sections about what to believe, right? And what's good and what's bad and how to live. Just make it really clear for us, please, God. Right? But instead, he gave us what we have, this beautiful story. It's a story. It's like a dramatic movie and then lots of poetry. And so we have to learn to appreciate it for what it is. Okay, but before we show the video, the Hebrew poetry is very different than our modern, especially American poetry. So, which is often based on rhyme and syllables. So when we read the Hebrew poetry, we're often like, this is weird. Like, you know, and also it's translated, right? Because it wasn't written in English. So, you know, even reading like Chinese poetry translated in English is going to be feel a little bit different. So we need a little bit of help to get us into the poetry of the Bible. So I have this, Alfred, you can put that up. But this is going to be a video by the Bible Project, just giving us some basic explanation of how Hebrew poetry works. And then after that, we're going to read a poem. Actually was read already, Psalm 1 together, and try to sit in it a little bit together. So whenever you're ready, Alfred, you can play the video, please.
So we've been learning how to read biblical narrative and showing how the Bible is one unified story. But 30% of the Bible is made up of ancient poetry. And I don't know about you, but I don't read a lot of stories where one out of three pages is some kind of poem.
Yet poetry is everywhere in the Bible. Some biblical books are entirely poetry. Most of the Hebrew prophets wrote masterful poems, and the majority of God's speech in the Bible is represented as poetry. It's also very common in biblical narrative for the story to pause while a character breaks out in poetic song. Like in the Exodus story, there's a narrative about Moses leading the Israelites through the waters of the sea, and that's followed by a beautiful poem about the very same thing.
Why a story and a poem? Wouldn't one version suffice?
Well, poetry has a different purpose than stories. Instead of describing the difference, let's just experience it.
Okay.
So, one part of the story goes like this.
The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through on dry land with a wall of water on their right and on their left.
That seems pretty clear.
Right.
Now, the poem, telling the same event.
O Lord, by the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. Surging waters stood like a wall. Deep waters congealed in the heart of the sea. Whoa, a wall of surging water, like jello and divine nostrils? This is intense.
Yeah, the poem ignites your imagination through the experience of verbal art. And biblical poets did this with a specific set of tools. And that's what we're going to look at, the art of biblical poetry. The basic unit of any poem is the line. And then many lines are designed together to make a poem.
Okay, I'm used to this kind of poem. There's a meter, cadence, bum-ba-ba-bum, bum-ba-ba-bum, and there's rhyme. But poems in the Bible don't work like this.
Yeah, biblical poems are what you could call free verse. They don't use meter like some traditions of poetry do, and they don't use rhyme in the same way either.
So biblical poems have no order to them?
No, they just have a different kind of order. Biblical poems are most basically structured by couplets, two short lines that are carefully worded and placed beside each other. The first line makes the basic statement, and then the second line develops it in some way. It can do this by completing the thought, or deepening it with different words or images, or by contrasting it in some way. So check out the opening of Psalm 51. You can see it in action. In the first couplet, the poet asks God to show grace and love. But how exactly? In the second line, he requests forgiveness for his failures.
Okay, so this couplet is finishing one complete thought.
Right. And then the next couplet opens with washing as a metaphor. And then the second line offers a more vivid image, that of a priest in the temple purifying things so they can be in God's presence.
Okay, so taking an image and deepening it.
Right. And then this third couplet opens with the poet's awareness of his sin deep inside. And that's followed by a description of the sin being outside. It's like it's in public, visible to themselves and other people.
So this couplet takes an idea and contrasts it.
Exactly.
So couplets by nature are a bit repetitive.
But the repetitive language forces you to slow down and linger over the feeling and meaning of it all, looking at each idea from more than one angle. And then groups of couplets can come together around one key idea. It's like a diamond with many facets, each line offering a different glimpse into the same core reality.
So this poem is exploring what it's like to be forgiven, offered a second chance.
And that's the kind of experience that can change a person. It's worth savoring and pondering. Now, biblical poets also use repetition on a larger scale. In many poems, you'll find a key line that's repeated multiple times. That's called a refrain. Or they'll open and close the poem with a similar couplet. That's called an inclusio.
Now, so biblical poets love design.
Oh, yeah. These are works of verbal artistry. These poets use repetition to create all kinds of elaborate patterns that invite the reader to make connections between different parts of the whole poem that open up even deeper layers of meaning.
Cool. So I'm feeling at home with ancient Hebrew poetry.
But remember, poetry isn't something you master and then move on. Biblical poems are a bottomless well. They're packed with a surplus of meaning for those who are willing to slow down and ponder them.
And they're trying to pull my mind in new directions and discover new ideas.
Exactly. And there's even one more tool that biblical poets have to do that very thing. And that's what we'll look at in the next video.
Thank you for showing the video. I love the Bible Project, right? And why? Because it's beautiful. Did you see all that? Oh, I love it. Oh, you can watch the next video on your own. It's really good. All right, so we're going to read Psalm chapter 1 together. Psalm 1 is the poem. And again, I love what they said. Poetry is not just meant to be mastered, and you get it, right? You move on, right? So come back to this. We've already read it once earlier today. We're going to read it a second time. We're going to read it a third time at the end of the message. And I hope that you start to become curious and ponder together. So I'm going to read Psalm 1. It might be slightly different translation than what you had read earlier, but it's okay. You can just listen. And just listen to the poem being read. Blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do prospers. Not so the wicked. They are like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous, for the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to destruction. If you listen carefully, this poem paints a picture. It actually paints a picture for you, right? Of one person versus many. Did you hear it? It says, blessed is the one who doesn't sit, stand, or walk with the wicked, the sinners, and the mockers. There's one person surrounded. And this is a poem for people who feel surrounded by evil and corruption. And when I was young, this was definitely a poem that I skipped over very fast, right? But again, I grew up in an affluent suburb of Seattle where it felt like I had everything that I needed. And so I didn't know what evil and corruption looked like. You know, I didn't know what that was like. But in middle school, I knew what mockery was. Maybe some of you know what that's like too. Middle schoolers somehow are really good at mockery. Where do we learn how to do that, right? Suddenly you go from elementary school to middle school and suddenly everyone's an expert mocker. Just making fun of people, right? There's these pressures to be cool, to be funny, to fit in. And those who didn't fit in were bullied, made fun of, or disregarded. And I didn't know it, but I needed this poem. And I wish that I had read it a little more carefully back then. I needed this poem to give me strength and encouragement. Blessed is the one who does not sit in the company of mockers, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord. Some of you, however, might see wickedness regularly in your life. Maybe it's in the workplace. Maybe it's in your community. Wickedness is not foreign to you. It says, blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked. As a campus staff minister with InterVarsity, I get to have many interesting conversations with people from many different faith backgrounds and traditions. But across the board, I found that most people don't need to be convinced. By the time you're in college, most people don't need to be convinced that there is evil in this world, that there is violence and there is hatred. Most people don't need to be convinced of that. However, what's challenging about the Christian faith is that we are invited to look inside of us to see that we are often part of the problem. That's what gets people sometimes. But this goes for Christians as well, within the church, right? This isn't a poem about who's Christian and who's not. That's not what this poem is about. It's not about who goes to church and who doesn't. This poem is this year alone. If you look at the news, you can see that there have been many Christian leaders exposed for their corruption. So back then when the poem was written, and even today, this is not a poem about what your religious identity is. This is a poem about how you live your life. And so this poem gives us hope to follow God's law, but it also warns us to avoid the way of the wicked. You and I, sitting here today, are just as vulnerable to wickedness and corruption as anyone else. And the purpose of this poem is to help us choose the way of the Lord, right? Why? Because if you do, you become like a tree planted by streams of water. I love that image. I love that image. I was sitting, you know, just all this week as I was preparing, I was just thinking about that image. Like, wow, I want to be like a tree planted by streams of water. Are you delighting in the law of the Lord? If so, you are like a tree planted by streams of water. Are you avoiding the company of mockers? You are like a tree planted by streams of water. Are you surrounded by wicked people but refuse to walk in step with them? You are a tree planted by streams of water. Maybe it's because I've been living in the concrete jungle of New York City for the last 7 years, but this idea just captivates me. I want to be like a tree planted by streams of water. We need powerful images to describe life with God, right? Pure logic and doctrinal creeds don't always capture enough of our imaginations and hearts. The next time someone asks you, what is it like to be a Christian? Tell them it's like being a tree planted by streams of water. So let's take a deeper look at the poem. What does that mean? What does that look like? It says, you will bear fruit. Number one, you will bear fruit in season at the right time. It means you are patient, but not anxious. It means you are productive, but not enslaved to your work. You are generous because you trust that in season, God will help you bear fruit. That is what a tree planted by streams of water is like. Number two, it says your leaf does not wither. Your leaves don't wither, even because your strength comes from God. You are planted by streams of water. Your joy is not determined by your circumstances, your bank account, or your grades. Even in persecution, you have hope in Christ. Number three, whatever you do prospers, it says. Now, I had trouble with this because I get a little bit icky when people say, oh, believe in God and everything you do will work out. That's not always true. I don't think that's what this is saying, though. It says, your work is worship to the Lord, right? So what you do prospers because you pursue excellence, not for fame or selfish gain, but for the good of others and the beauty of the world. God gives you what you need. When people see that what you do is prospering, they say, oh, what's happening here, right? You are like a tree planted by streams of water, but not so the wicked. They are like chaff that the wind blows away. Those who mock you, they won't last. Believe it, believe it, believe it. Those who cheat will not win. Trust that. I'm turning 30 years old this September, and the last 20 years of my life, as I reflect, have been incredibly confusing. It feels like every 3 years, I feel like a new person who wants different things. You know, when I was 10 to 13, I just wanted to be cool and popular, right? And when I was 13 to 16, I wanted to be attractive to the girls at school. When I was 16 to 18 in high school, I wanted to get into a good college, a a music conservatory. That's what I wanted to get into. When I was in college, 18 to 21, I just wanted to be a better cellist than everyone else around me, right? That was my whole life. When I was 21 to 23, after I graduated, I wanted to get married and start a life with Carolina. When I was 23 to 26, I wanted to be the best I could be at my job, right? And these past 3 years, 26 to 29, I feel like a big priority has been, how can I become financially secure? How do I plan for the next decades of my life? Man, do you feel that? The wind blows fast. Something that's incredibly important to you, the most important thing, could be irrelevant for you in 3 years. It doesn't mean that these things don't matter, but it does mean that our lives change very quickly. And no matter what happens, no matter what is your priority, there's always a choice. And this is what the poem is talking about. The way of the wicked or the way of the righteous. The way of the wicked, the sinners and the mockers, or the way of the Lord. Again, this isn't talking necessarily about who's Christian and who's not, even though I think being Christian means following the way of the Lord, right? This means that in every moment in our life, we have a choice to make. How will you live? Maybe it's whether you should switch jobs or not. Maybe if it's whether this career is the right fit for you. Maybe it's a conflict with a friend or a family member or a significant other, or maybe it's your desires to be popular and successful. Those aren't necessarily bad in themselves. In each of those, however, we get to choose between the way of the wicked and the way of the righteous. And we must prayerfully consider in each of our circumstances, what is the way of the Lord? And as you do that, you will become like a tree planted by streams of water. Now, we're talking about poetry. I'm not saying that we all have to become poets or artists, even though I think if you want to, it's a great idea. The truth is, poetry isn't just words, right? Poetry is actually when you live a beautiful life, you become almost like this poem. You become a beautiful poem for the people around you. When your community lives beautifully, your community lives in the way of the righteous, you become like a poem to people because they look at you and they say, "Ooh, what's going on here?" Right? And so I just want to share a quick story to end about a community at a college campus that struck me as a tree planted by streams of water, like a beautiful poem. There was a first-year student at the Juilliard School. Her name is, I won't share her name, but she lives in China. And she got into Juilliard, but then the pandemic hits. So her entire first year has been on Zoom, attending Juilliard virtually from the other side of the world. But that also meant she had a 12-hour time difference. So 9 a.m. class starts at 9 p.m. for her, and she would take it until midnight, go to sleep, and then maybe wake up at 7 in the morning so she can play at her studio class at 7 p.m. in Eastern time, right? Very challenging. But also more challenging than that is, who's going to spend the time to get to know her? Nobody's met her before. How do you schedule? That's very challenging. And some of you, if you have family members in China, you know that it's challenging. Except for the first year women's Bible study with Juilliard Christian Fellowship. They heard about her and that she had expressed some interest in getting involved with InterVarsity. So they reached out and together they said, you know what? We could schedule our small group Bible study at a time when it's convenient for us, when it works best for us. Or we could schedule it at a time that works for her. 12-hour difference. But that's really hard. I'm busy. I have so much to do. Like, we can't do that. I only have 1 hour slot for this. And they realized, well, we could wake up earlier and start our small group Bible study at 8 a.m. 8 a.m. College students don't wake up at 8 a.m. Don't you know? You can't do that. But they prayed about it. And they felt like, I think that together we should welcome this girl. And they did. And so often throughout the year, they've had Bible studies where they had to wake up before 8 so that they could meet with her because it was 8 p.m. her time. And you know what happened? She loved it. She was blown away that this group of people on the other side of the world would sacrifice to welcome her And she became the most consistent member all year. And I could tell you so many more stories about the impact on her life, and not only her, but her family, right? I could go into that. But to me, that community is like a tree planted by streams of water. And I believe this church is as well. You are like a tree planted by streams of water. So I'm going to read the poem one last time to close us. Again, I want you just to listen to it. Don't analyze it. Just experience the poem together. Blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord, who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do prospers. Not so the wicked. They are like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous, for the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to destruction. What a great poem. You know, there's so many more in the Bible. I hope that today this encourages you to open the scriptures and not just look for information, but experience the beauty of these people's experience with God. Just to close us as we finish today, this poem is actually, there's so much more going on in this poem than I just scratched the surface. Because if you paid attention carefully to the image, the center of this poem is of a tree planted by streams of water. Have you ever heard of a tree in the Bible before? The Bible starts with a tree planted by four streams of water. And at the end of the Bible as well, in Revelation chapter 22, it talks about, I'll just read it for you. And he showed me a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb. And in the middle of its streets, on either side of the river, was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. I'm just reading Revelation 22 here. Isn't that amazing? And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And at the climax of this grand story that we call the Bible stands one person who didn't walk with the wicked, who delighted in the law of the Lord. And this person even suffered unjustly and died at the hands of his enemies. But that person is like a tree planted by streams of water. And so after 3 days, he was raised to life and seated at the right hand of God. Jesus is our tree of life. As we follow him, who is our way of righteousness, we too, you too, we will become like a tree planted by streams of water. Let me pray. Dear God, thank you so much for your word, which is beautiful, amazing. How could anyone have written this? And may you draw us to greater worship and love for you and love for others, and call us to the way of the righteous, that we may be like a tree planted by streams of water.